KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
King County Executive Dow Constantine joins us in our studios on a Monday instead of a Thursday because you had something else you were doing.
Stuff to do.
Pleasure to see you.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I talked to Mark Arm of Mudhoney last week, and he mentioned that back in the day, I didn't know this, when KUOW and KCMU were interlinked before it became KEXP and we were in the communications building, I knew you worked there as a DJ, and so did he as well.
He did indeed.
He had a specialty show?
It is. There were a lot of folks who had specialty shows there that turned into things. Mark was there. John Poneman and Bruce Pavitt had a show called Sub Pop, which turned into a little something. Kim Thayil was there. He ended up being in Soundgarden. Saw him the other day at the Mariners game. There are a lot of us kicking around Seattle who got our start in that crummy little studio on the top floor of the communications building, I guess yourself included.
Yes, though.
Your studio was a little more luxurious.
Yeah, it really was a lot more luxurious than the KCMU studios. That's right. Well, that's interesting. And on your iPod, little bit of that music still of that era?
Yeah, there is an eclectic mix of music on my metaphoric iPod. And made a quick trip up to Vancouver a week ago to see my old friend Billy Bragg play. And then tonight, I'm going to try to catch Johnny Marr, late of the Smiths, at Numos. He's playing, you know, he kind of, I think, splits his time between Portland and London, or has in the past, and he's got a new album out, and he's going to be playing tonight.
Music still matters.
Yeah. Music's an important part of my life, and I like popular music, I like classical music, and I enjoy, when possible, getting out to see live performance. And
yeah.
The good news is that most rock shows don't start till 8, 9, or 10 o'clock at night, so I'm not scheduled usually at that time.
Really? That schedule? You're
if you just leave out the sleep, there's plenty of time for everything.
I figure. So you kicked off your reelection campaign March 14th. Isn't that what you have to do at night, raise money?
You know, the fundraisers are usually 5:30 till 7:30, so if you can make a quick change out of the suit, it works out okay, but I am spending a lot of my spare time now doing the necessary work of making phone calls and holding little events to get reelected.
I read that you had $500,000. You'd raised $500,000?
We raised about that. I have somewhere north of $300,000 in the bank.
How much money did you have to spend last time to be elected?
I raised and spent $1.5 million last time. And then there were independent expenditures that were done on my behalf that I don't really know. There were more than that. But the county is big. There are 2 million people in this jurisdiction, and you know, more than half of them are registered voters. So it does take quite a bit of money to reach that many folks. And that is just one of the grim realities of serving in public office. You got to get elected. And if you're going to get elected, you have to be able to communicate with people. And that, except on KOW, costs money.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll have to spend more this time or about the same?
It all depends on how the field shakes out.
You haven't heard anything?
Filings in a month. Other constant rumors.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really pay to worry about them until you see what really happens, and then go from there.
What haven't you finished? What haven't you accomplished that you want a second term?
Well, I think we've accomplished what we said we would, which is putting the county back on sound financial footing and setting in place the reforms that are going to allow us to succeed as the economy recovers. I'm not going to give my whole campaign speech here because we want to talk about policy, but what I would like to have happen now is for us to get back to the work of investing in our infrastructure that's been neglected during this recession and, in fact, before. The physical infrastructure, like the roads and the transit system, but also the human infrastructure, human services and education and the natural infrastructure. And we've been making some progress on that by being, I think, pretty clever over the course of the last several months. We managed to set aside 43,000 acres of the White River Forest that I mentioned when I was here last time in perpetuity. It's available for logging, but not available for development. And that is going to be a great asset for those who come after us.
But you had hoped the legislature would allow you a little more flexibility in terms of transit taxes. You have gone to the House, where the Democrats hold sway. Are you going to get that?
It's unclear right now. The fact is that we need additional authority to be able to keep the buses on the road. We're looking at the elimination next year of about 65 bus routes entirely and the reductions of another 86 routes. And that is bad for the economy, bad for individuals, and bad for the environment because that puts tens of thousands of cars back on the road and bad for everybody who's driving in traffic, by the way. Last week, I stood with Governor Inslee and the chair of the House Transportation Committee, Judy Cliburn, down at the Port of Tacoma, where they announced their initiative to have a comprehensive transportation package that includes something called the Pacific Gateway, which is a completion of State Highways 509 and 167, as well as local transportation funding and funding for transit. And, you know, what we have been asking for are local options so that we can step up and meet our local responsibility. This is not about expansion of roads. It's about repair and maintenance of roads so that we can responsibly care for the legacy we've been handed by those who came before us. And I think that we have a reasonable chance, even in this difficult legislature, because historically transportation has been a bipartisan issue.
Even with the transit, even with funding for Metro?
You know, there are the advocates for transit are not limited to just the riders or just the, say, environmental community. When we were faced with a crisis 2 years ago, the education community, broadly the business community led by the Chamber of Commerce and the Downtown Seattle Association and Microsoft and others stepped up and said, this is critical to our economy. This is the workhorse, the backbone of our local economy. We cannot allow transit to be diminished. And so we have a broad coalition that speaks to Republicans and Democrats. And if those representatives are listening, they will hear that there's a need, if we're going to have economic recovery, to fund transit.
That sounds like you're still trying to convince them.
It's, you know, there's the sort of reflexive anti-tax sentiment among particularly the Senate Republicans in Olympia. And, you know, we're not asking them to raise taxes. We're asking them to give us locally in King County and the other central Puget Sound counties the authority to fix our own problems, to deal with our own challenges, and in doing so, to lift up the entire state. It's, I think, a reasonable request and one that our people support.
King County Executive Dow Constantine is our guest. We're going to take some of your calls as well. If you have questions for Dow at 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. So it was at the beginning of April that Metro GM Kevin Desmond, you said, possible cut of 65 Metro routes without additional funding from the vehicle fees, which is that excise, that surcharge is going away, or other initiatives. So today, April 15th, are those routes going to be cut, do you think?
We are continuing to press the point in the legislature that we need authority to replace the $20 vehicle license fee that's going away. And the
When's it go away again?
It goes away mid-2014. It was 2 years from the date it was enacted and went into effect by the county. And then, but we've been pairing that $20 with money from the Metro reserves that we've been drawing down over time. So it's not just the $20 that needs to be replaced because those reserves are now going to be gone as well. And the working assumption at the start of this was that by that time we would have a permanent funding source to keep transit on the road. And we're still working on that.
What would you like to see as the permanent source?
You know, working within the constraints of the tax system we have, which is a difficult one. It's a piecemeal one. Transportation-related charges, including vehicle license fees, are a reasonable way to pay for transit. But there are other possibilities. The legislature has not been too enthusiastic about having part of tolls pay for transit. But in fact, when we put transit on the structures we're building, like new bridges, it dramatically increases the capacity of those structures and reduces the congestion on those structures. I think there's a good argument for that. There are a number of authorities we already have, including a vehicle license fee under statute that could be imposed, but only on a local jurisdiction basis, city by city, and the unincorporated county, which doesn't help the transit system much because we're a region-wide system. There are gas taxes, but those can only be used for roads under our state constitution. So, you know, we are looking to the legislature to craft a solution that allows us to succeed, and I don't want to box them in too much by prescribing a particular type of tax. I want to have them understand the need and do what they're elected to do, which is solve problems.
But you think there's tools out there that would not gore any one particular ox?
Every tool that we have is to some extent imperfect. And so trying to share the responsibility fairly, and that means having, you know, riders pay their share and the general public pay their share, just as drivers pay a share and the general public pays a share for roads, is the best approach. And we have raised fares 4 times in the last few years, and we'll probably end up doing it again before too terribly long. But, you know, transit, like roads, are something that are a general public good, and general taxes need to pay for a good part of it.
Of course, that raising the fares doesn't get you very far, does it?
Our riders are paying, I think, close to 30% right now, which is 27.5%, which is above our target, you know, which is 25%, which is a pretty typical target for fare box recovery around the country. It does not raise a huge amount of money, but trying to keep sort of a fair share is important. And, you know, in the end, we want people to ride the bus because it makes the roads function better. It makes the economy function better. And, you know, if you're a driver in your single occupancy vehicle, you want a lot of folks on the bus and not all in their own single occupancy vehicles.
By the way, the other thing you were talking about was that, as you mentioned this already, but the county identified 35 bridges it says are in danger of closing because funds are not available to properly maintain or replace them. Then you also highlighted a dozen roadways that need significant reconstruction. Would those bridges and roads, not new roads as you mentioned, would those be included in the transportation package funding that the governor and Judy Cliburn were talking about?
Yes. We and our cities worked over the course of the last legislative interim to agree on kind of the problem statement, the unmet need for road maintenance and repair. And so that has always been paired with the request for transit money, and we will continue to insist that we have to maintain our roads. It's the only responsible thing to do, and to maintain the availability of transit for a growing population. And we are united with our 39 cities in King County around that agenda, and gratefully, Representative Cliburn and the governor recognize that and are including it in their requests.
You know, there was an op-ed in the paper, I think it was yesterday, in the Seattle Times, arguing that the connections in – actually, it was the Seattle Times' own editorial – arguing that the connections between the port and the highways is not being maintained or crafted well, and that the roads themselves down in that area – I understand this is a city, but you see where I'm going with this. The roads themselves are just – you know, there's a lot of beat-up roads, a lot of dirt roads. Who's taking on that sort of regional, which is a regional kind of concept? Mm-hmm. Who's taking on that those projects?
Well, there's a direct answer, and there's a larger conversation. The direct answer is that those are mostly city streets other than the state highways, many of which will be able to be helped with the $40 million that's set aside in the ARENA proposal. There's a $40 million SOTO infrastructure fund. As I've said throughout this conversation around basketball, there's a lot of potential capacity in SOTO that is underutilized, not optimized. Some of it's mostly potholes. And we could do a lot better in moving trucks and commuters and buses around. The larger conversation is this, and we've been having this conversation with our cities. Our road system is not 40 separate road systems within this county, even though we have 40 separate governments, local governments responsible for them. We have a regional road system that serves a regional economy, And we need to begin having a portion of our transportation funding aimed at dealing with the regional arterial or regional commuter system. And that goes to freight as well. And we, I think, are in a much better position now, united around the need for local transportation funding, to be able to prioritize freight and commuter mobility throughout the region rather than doing everything on a city-by-city, town-by-town basis. The mayors of the major cities and I have been in conversations around this for a couple of years now. I think that they all agree that we're one big economy and that, for instance, the warehousing in the Kent Valley depends on good freight mobility between there and the seaport and the airports. And, you know, because we are, I think, working in better partnership now, we're in a better position to be able to make the system a lot more efficient than it has been over the course of the last several years.
All right. One phone call before the break. Bashi's in Seattle looking at taxi cabs. Hi, Bashi.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call. How are you, Dow Constantine?
I'm very good, Bashi. Thanks for calling.
I hope you remember we met several times. We had some meeting based on a taxi industry. I did submit a proposal almost 2 years ago, based on what's going on in taxi industry. We have a 220 dual license at the airport, and we have 243 county licenses who are not allowed to work in downtown Seattle. We have almost 300 cab city licenses who are not allowed to work in the county. Based on that, we have a special committee going on in the city right now. Sally Clark is the chair, and it is me who came up with all this idea. Are you going to go ahead, convince the city council to offer dual licenses within the city and the county? That's the question I'm asking.
Dual licenses for city and county cabs?
There is no more Byzantine area that one could identify than the area of taxis and for-hire vehicles. We have city licenses, we have county licenses, and then the port licenses taxis for the airport. And then there's a separate category of cars that are called for-hire, and you see them more and more, where they're not allowed to simply pick people up at the curb. They need to be called for a particular pickup. And each one of these has a constituency, and even within those constituencies, there are disagreements about the correct approach. I would like us, and so about four or five years ago, we created a joint taxi commission with the city. And what I want that commission to do is make this system in a way that's fair to those who've made real investments in their licenses and their cars, make the system much simpler, make the system more customer-friendly, because you can go to a lot of cities where it's a lot easier and more transparent using the taxi system, whether it's Las Vegas or New York or just about anywhere you go. And ultimately, to have a system that allows people to be able to get a cab when they need it, not have to have a car of their own all the time and the expense that goes along with it. Is a joint city-county license the correct answer? Logically, it seems like it, and yet undoubtedly there are people who are going to be inconvenienced or feel that they're being treated unfairly.
But if you're 5 years into this, it sounds like it remains intractable.
I'm not sure it's intractable, but there are long histories with all this, and as deeply as I've gotten into this, I feel as though I've just scratched the surface of understanding where all the interests lie.
Of course, he was saying, are you going to the city council to talk to them? Is that a plan of yours, to try to lobby them to go for the joint city-county license?
When this commission and we have a proposal that makes sense and is fair, as can be accomplished to everyone involved, I'll be glad to lobby both the county and the city.
Do they have a time frame? This commission?
I'm not clear about whether they have a time frame right now. The sooner the better.
The sooner the better, but it sounds like it's still, as you say, Byzantine.
Yep.
Absolutely. All right. There's as close an answer as we got, Bashi.
Sorry, Bashi. As good as I can do.
Let me take a break. We'll come back with Dow Constantine. This is Weekday.
-47 degrees in Seattle. It's cloudy. Forecast says partly sunny later. Chance of showers today and a high of 56.
K KUOW and Seattle Children's Theater present Crash. A middle school football star discovers empathy in this story about bullying and friendship, based on author Jerry Spinelli's chapter book. April 18th through May 19th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
1025, I'm Bernard Ouellet. Should companies be allowed to patent human genes? It's happening, and it's been happening. Not everyone likes it. Now the Supreme Court is taking up the issue. More on that just a bit later this hour.
We're talking with King County Executive Dow Constantine. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention that among the things in Hoosh that Jason Anthony says they eat in Antarctica, or they ate in Antarctica when they were exploring, seal brain on toast.
I don't want any.
No. It's supposed to be very good for some. Some people really liked it.
I mean, if I was starving in Antarctica, I might, but no.
All right. Fair enough. Yeah, I don't know what happened to our headphones, Dow Constantine. Sounds very weird.
Got a little bit of reverb there.
Yeah, we'll just take them away.
Okay.
Yeah, very weird reverb. Tell me something. What is happening with the King County Parks Foundation right now? You know, the city is dealing with trying to fund its parks as well. What's happening with King County Parks?
So the Parks Foundation is something I announced last week. And what we did was work with Laird Norden Wealth Management to have them create an initial gift of $75,000 to start a foundation with a goal of raising $7.5 million to support the acquisition and maintenance of our park system. We have about 80% of our parks are paid for through our parks levy, and then another 20% is paid for through entrepreneurial activities, like, you know, renting out Marymore Park for Cirque du Soleil, for example. That was the goal we set for parks. They're accomplishing it. It's still not enough to build the trails, expand the park system to meet the needs of a growing population. Laird Norden stepped forward, and they said they wanted to help, along with the Seattle Foundation, to create a new foundation for King County Parks, as they have had in Seattle. And so Bob Moser, the president and CEO of Laird Norden Wealth Management, is going to work with me, and we're being housed by the Seattle Foundation, to raise those funds to help expand our park system. We have 200 parks, 26,000 acres of open space, 175 miles of regional trails like the bike trails, and then another 185 miles of backcountry trails. The King County Park System is 75 years old this year. It's one of the finest in the nation. It's a great legacy, and it's one that we need to reinvest in and to expand. And I could not be happier that we have had an announcement like this. We're on our way to, I think, a new way of doing business, certainly, but bigger and better things for the park system.
You know, you said we're an expanding population. How big have you guys done calculations? How big should a park system be as the population expands?
Well, right now we have pretty high demand on a lot of our parks, both the fields and active recreation, and also the wilderness areas, the trails like Cougar Mountain, for example. We know that at least another 500,000 people are coming to King County over the course of the next 15 to 20 years, and far more.
Yeah, and a million something over the
far more to the region, and a million something and by 2050.
Yeah.
And that number of people need the opportunity to experience wilderness, to play sports, to, you know, get away from their intense urban environment. And having these spaces allows us to have more intensive development in the urban centers. So I don't think we have a specific acreage, but we do know that there are still great places in this county that can be saved and preserved. There are the opportunities to develop fields for, you know, kids to play soccer, or the adults to play soccer. And there are other emerging sports. For instance, there's a big demand now for, bike trails, not just for commuters, but for recreation. And so we're trying to make sure that we cover those needs as well.
All right. So how are the cities doing in providing their citizens with park space. Because, of course, when the crisis hit King County Parks, some of those cities were asked to absorb or take over parks.
There were a lot of parks inside cities that were essentially local parks. There were smaller parks, smaller fields, and the cities took those over, and they're doing a good job with them. There are also city parks that are treated like regional parks by the region. And this, you know, this goes back to our conversation about regional roads. We are more and more an integrated region. And as time moves on, our funding needs to reflect that. So in the parks levy that you'll see this fall in the August ballot, this is a renewal of the parks levy, there is funding for city parks as well as for the county park system. So we understand that this is a system that covers a county of 2 million people. It's not 40 separate park systems. And we try to have the funding address that reality.
That's going to be property tax money, right?
Yeah.
That levy.
Yeah.
Property taxes due at the end of this month. Mm-hmm. So people are looking at their property tax and seeing what they are paying for. Mm-hmm. Is there room? Is there room to raise, like a parks levy property tax? Room on the tax.
Yeah. There is room. There are some junior taxing districts that are currently being squeezed because of the decline in the total assessed valuation across the county. The property values have gone down countywide, and they're recovering pretty well in some of the urban centers like Seattle and Bellevue, more slowly in the places that are farther away from the urban center. But you see thing like our upcoming emergency medical services levy, which will be on the November ballot. This, again, is a renewal. The average homeowner will pay $3 less over the course per year over the course of the next 6 years than they did under this previous levy, even though the per thousand millage is higher because property values have declined. And it is a challenge for junior taxing districts because there's a statutory limit on the total property tax burden that can be assessed within the county.
What's a junior taxing?
So like a hospital district. There's a lot of separate governments under state law, and they're kind of prioritized in terms of where they are in the pecking order for property taxes. So we try to make sure when there's something like emergency medical services or a parks levy that in having the voters approve that, we're not squeezing out a local parks district or a local hospital district. And if we are, we usually try to figure out how we can make up for that, make them whole, so that they're not losing their ability to maintain their local park because we have emergency medical services in the county. Again, our state tax system is a little bit goofy, but with a lot of smart people looking at it, we can figure out how to make these things work. And I do, I mentioned the EMS levy. I want to just touch on that. We are incredibly fortunate in our region to have this 911 system, this Medic One system, that allows us to have a 52% survival rate for people experiencing a heart attack in our region. That compares to something on the order of 10% or less across the county. And it is because we created this region-wide system. And we tax ourselves.
Across the country.
Yeah.
Not the county. Across the country, that 10%.
Across the country.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And we tax ourselves about $110 a year. It'll be $107 a year under this new levy to pay for a system that allows you to call 911 and get a very high level of service when you have an emergency. And the fact that that is in place is a really significant part of the quality of life here in King County. And it's something that people may take for granted, but we ought not to. The emergency medical services levy is likely going to be on in November.
Hmm. Oh, it's not for sure on yet?
The county council has received recommendation from the regional committee. The various cities, the larger cities, all are in a kind of UN Security Council on this thing. They each have the ability to weigh in on it, and they've been working with each other to find the correct level for the levy. And I think that we have reached, I hope we've reached accord on that, and the county council will be taking it up and sending it to the ballot.
Let me bring in Joe for a minute with Dow Constantine, since we were talking earlier about buses and metro fares and the like. Joe's in Kent. Hi, Joe.
Hi. An honor to meet you, sir.
How are you, Joe?
I'd like to let you know, for a long time, I commuted by bus from Bellevue to Seattle and back. And I usually go in the mornings, but also at other times during the day. And one thing I noticed constantly, no matter what line I took, or there's a lot of people using the bus system that aren't paying. They'll either get on and say they forgot their pass or their money, and the driver would wave them through, or they get on and say, oh, my pass is in my briefcase, and they just head down to the end of the bus and not be called back. Or they'd get on and just throw in a small amount of the change required and just walk down the aisle. Now, this happens a lot, and I feel the system is really bleeding money here. And occasionally, if there was someone undercover from either Metro or the police that would spot check these things, or if there was some kind of sign urging people to report if the bus driver isn't collecting fares, this would help stem a lot of loss in money. And I think everyone has to pay their fair share. And it used to really irritate me because I was paying, and I'm not Bill Gates, you know.
Well, here, let me, is there data that tells you that people are shirking on paying their fares with riders?
I don't know what kind of data there is. I do know that fare evasion is an issue for every transit system that doesn't have a turnstile like at a subway. And there are different philosophies for dealing with it. I, like you, caller, tend to get really aggravated with people who try to cheat. I don't like people cut in line, and I don't like people who get on the bus and don't pay their fare. There you have to balance that with the need to keep the bus moving and not have the driver get bogged down in arguments with everybody who comes on and tries to. And also, we can't have the drivers getting in altercations with people. Folks get aggravated, and it slows the whole system down. So we don't ask our bus drivers to be police. We do have transit security. And on the rapid ride routes where you board have fare inspectors, we found that compliance is much higher because we have these inspectors coming through the bus and randomly checking people to see if they have paid their fare. And I imagine that as the system evolves and goes to more of a corridor model, we'll be able to see a lot more of that kind of approach. I would love for us to get to a point where we had a system that has people paying before they get on the vehicle and that has some sort of turnstile or gate system. But frankly, with this very diffuse transit system we have to rely on the drivers and onboard payment to keep the system moving.
All right, last question for you. You're in New York. You were there with the NBA when the presentation was made. Maybe the NBA will make a decision this week, or maybe they will punt on whether...
Not to mix our sports metaphors.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. What should I say? Air. Maybe they'll throw an air ball. What if the NBA says, you know, Sacramento has stepped up, they're going to stay there, and you know, you guys, maybe we'll get an expansion team for you in a couple of years. How much would that have cost the county?
We're in a position to be reimbursed by Hanson's group for the costs of the work we've done so far. What I think the NBA ought to do is think about how much bigger and better the Seattle market is. And frankly, our business proposal is a heck of a lot better than the Sacramento one, which, while earnest, is not fully formed yet. It's kind of a last-minute deal. The NBA has to make their own decisions. In the past, they've made decisions purely based on their business interests. If they pursue that, they will choose Seattle. If I was an NBA owner, first of all, I'd be a lot wealthier. But second of all, I might choose to create an expansion team for Sacramento so that when they have a proposal that's fully cooked, they could have a team as well. But I got to tell you, Chris Hansen was mighty impressive putting together that presentation that we made to the owners group, and as well as Steve Ballmer and the Nordstroms. And it was a fascinating experience to be there with all these folks who are operating in, let's just say, a much different environment than I operate in on a daily basis.
Think we'll know this week?
I kind of do. Sort of emerging bidding war is probably going to be of interest, but also a little alarming to the commissioner. And I think they may want to just bring it to a head and deal with this.
Dow Constantine is King County Executive. Appreciate you coming in.
Great to be here.
This is Weekday.
1039. The U.S. Supreme Court is taking up the patenting of human genes. We'll take a look at the debate in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Cornell Queens Executive MBA program, designed for mid-career managers and professionals, offering weekend classes in Seattle. Local admissions events April 22nd and 23rd. Information and event registration at cornellseattle.com.
Forty-eight degrees in Seattle, quite a few clouds in the sky. Forecast says partly sunny this afternoon, chance of showers and a high of 56. Overnight, partly cloudy, 39. Tomorrow, Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high of 59.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington. Jim and Andy Workhoven are Washington dairy farmers who are working to help save salmon spawning ground. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
1041, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Dish Network, the satellite TV provider, wants to buy Sprint Nextel for $25 billion. More about the proposed deal in the news at 11.
Joint demands. Hey, guess what? Our guests for this other segment, they're not answering the phone. So I thought I could just ask you something.
What was the other segment?
Why, you think you can talk on it? I'm ready for you to go. U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in the case Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics. It's about patenting genes and whether that's a legal or a good idea.
Legal or ethical.
Yeah.
Or smart.
Well, or smart.
Sounds dangerous, but there you have it. It's my two cents. Back on the taxi issue.
That's why we thought, because you got an answer.
Yes. I'm informed that we're in the midst of a joint study with the city about the demand for taxi service in the city and county. And once we get that demand-side information, will be in a better position to try to chart a course to rationalize the system.
Yeah, it's a good way of asking you this bigger question, which I thought I'd just take the time to ask. Does it boggle your mind that there'll be another million people here in 40 years?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, a million's a lot of folks. And, in King County, we have done a very good job with growth management, not just of holding the line at the fringes, but of making the centers more attractive, investing in the infrastructure you need for people to want to come forward or want to move into the centers and to build for a much more sustainable future. And if that model is adopted in our neighboring counties as well, we can certainly accommodate more population and keep the things that we all value, the natural environment, the quality of life.
Well, that's what we haven't necessarily been seeing in Pierce, Thurston, or to some extent even Snohomish County. Their land use planning is a little different than King County.
It's a little more diffuse.
Diffuse there. A nice way of putting
it. But, as people see how successful places like downtown Bellevue have become, and downtown Redmond is following, and when we get light rail all the way to the center of Redmond, even more so. I think that there will be greater demand by those city councils and their constituents to emulate that. Where we have dense or walkable urban centers, you have stable single-family neighborhoods, and you still have farms and forests and places to get out in the wilderness.
It's such an amazing dance that that you have to go through.
Very
All right, that was nice of you to stay and answer that question for me, since we had to get these guys on the phone.
You found them?
Yeah, they showed up.
Outstanding.
All right. We'll see in the where are you going to be at Numo's? We'll see you at Numo's, isn't it?
Tonight.
Yeah, I'll be there for sure. I don't know how you do it. You are just a strong person. I'm a weak person.
Caffeine.
Dow Kotstein is the King County executive. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
By the way, the U.S. Supreme Court, just to follow on, heard arguments in the case Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics today. The Association for Molecular Pathology has joined the ACLU to argue against the constitutionality of patenting human genes. Myriad Genetics, a biotech company, holds a patent on the genes BRCA1 and BRCA2. If a person is found to have that particular genetic sequence, they are likely to develop breast or ovarian cancer. Doctors and researchers feel that the ability to patent human genes is detrimental to their work, restricting what they can study and how they treat their patients. Some do. And some want the court to rule that isolated genes are unpatentable products of nature. Proponents of the patents say that It encourages innovation in genetic research by making the discoveries more profitable. Dr. Christopher Holman is associate professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His research focus is on the intersection of intellectual property and biotech. Skeptical in some ways, Dr. Holman, of the anti-patent side. Do you think the anti-patent side is throwing too wide a net over this issue?
Yeah, well, in terms of this case, for one thing, the way it's being characterized, it's very clear that you cannot patent human genes as they exist in the body, as a gene actually exists. These are patents directed towards synthetic DNA molecules that have a DNA sequence, so they have some of the information that you would have on a naturally occurring gene, but these are not naturally occurring genes. And the fact is, these type of patent claims have been around for at least 30 years. They've been part of the foundation for the biotech industry. The understanding has been that you can get these kind of patents, and they've never been a problem, at least in the sense of actually being asserted against somebody in court for doing any kind of research or genetic diagnostic testing of humans. So it's all a kind of a fear that there could be a potential problem somewhere down the road, based in large part, I think, on a misunderstanding of patent law and what these patents actually would be able to prevent people from doing, and what people are free to do, which including things like doing research, of which there has been quite a bit on the BRCA genes, regardless of these patents.
Hey, Dr. Holman, I have to ask, just because we hear it, are you by a snowplow, or are you on a beach?
I don't know what that. I'm under. That's someone else. I'm in a quiet office.
Isn't that funny?
I hear something also. That's not. I don't know. I hear it, but it's not coming from my end.
No.
Unless there's something in the phone.
Oh, I see. I see. Well, I like the idea of you being on a beach, so I'm going to imagine that.
That'd be nice.
let me ask you another question. You said that this has been around for 30 years. What examples of other genes or these kinds of genes that have been patented are there? Examples of that?
Yeah, there's many thousands. Every patent there's no such thing as a gene patent, but there's lots of patents that would cover isolated DNA sequences that have something that are related in structure to actual genes. And so a lot of the products of the biotech industry, so for example, one of the most well-known, I think it's the most commercially successful biotech product, is recombinant erythropoietin. It's a drug, it's kind of notorious for people like Lance Armstrong using it in blood doping. They talked about it with the Blade Runner guy. But this was a big deal. This is for people suffering from anemia. It was developed by a large biotech company in California called Amgen. They had to go to court to protect their franchise. So they invested a lot of money to develop this product, the recombinant erythropoietin, and they were looking at competition from other drug companies. And they were able to go in just like any drug company and try to keep the market to themselves for a certain number of years. And the patent they used is a gene patent that had claims no different than in this Myriad case. And way back in the, I guess that was 1980s, the court found, these claims are fine, they're valid. So that's the history. These claims have been around. They've been directed towards a lot of really important genes that have become drugs. Mostly, they've been directed at DNA sequences that have no real commercial significance, at least in patenting. So actually, even though a lot of these patents were issued, most of them appear not to be in force anymore because to keep a patent in force, you need to pay maintenance fees periodically. And for a huge number of these, the owners are not paying maintenance fees, indicating that they don't really see a much of a value in them.
I see. Dr. Christopher Holman is associate professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His research focuses on the intersection of intellectual property and biotechnology. Dr. Robert Cook Deegan is research professor in genome ethics and law and policy at Duke University. Dr. Cook Deegan, you were listening to what Dr. Holman said. I think we may have cleared up our sound problem as well. What's the problem, as you see it, let me say it a different way. What are the issues, as you see it, in the Supreme Court case that's before the court today, molecular pathology versus Myriad Genetics?
Yeah, so I think Chris did a really nice job of teeing this up. And I think he's done a really valuable service in narrowing the debate about these patents and pointing out that the situation is not as catastrophic as many people would assert. The question now is there still a residual problem? So let's go back to the example he gave of the patents on erythropoietin. The gene patent there was something that allowed the production of a valuable protein, and the gene patent was part of a production process that led to a drug being formed in cells based on recombinant DNA. And in the United States, Amgen won. It didn't play out the same way in Europe. And that's kind of how we're used to patents working, is you use patents to protect something that's expensive to develop, costs a lot of money, and you test it clinically, and it gets added to the set of treatments that we have. That's a different situation from diagnostics, where what you're trying to do is extract information about the genes that are in somebody's cells and in somebody's bodies. And what's at stake in this case is actually close to diagnostics. So, well, in fact, it is diagnostics. That's what Myriad does for a living. But it's kind of the same patent framework. It's the blockbuster patent on a particular product. And that's really what the Supreme Court was dealing with today, is can you patent the gene in such a way that it also affects the extraction of the information from a person's body? And I apologize. I'm probably the source of the extra noise here.
No, but we've cleaned it up a little bit. I get it now. Are you in somewhere fun, though? Are you at a beach or something?
I'm on the street in Washington, D.C., trying to get from one patent event to another patent event, and I really do apologize.
Oh, that's fine. Well, I like thinking of it as a beach, but I guess Washington, D.C. traffic is fair enough as well. Tell me, so the crux of the concern is that it's the information that comes along with the extraction that that opponents are afraid of, that I guess is this a little bit like what we were concerned about with Henrietta Lack, the woman who so much information was extracted from her blood that somebody loses their own control?
So here's the thing that's weird about DNA, is it is a molecule, and you can engineer it and you can do cool things with it. And a lot of those cool things involve engineering and things that they really intuitively feel like patentable inventions. But it is also a storage and transmission medium for biological information. And when you're doing a diagnostic test, what you're trying to do is find out what is the sequence of base pairs in that person's cells. That's the question you're asking. And if your test changes the DNA sequence, then you're actually giving the wrong answer. So what's funny about diagnostics is it's valuable only to the extent that you actually copy the same information that is in a person's cells. That's why this is a hard case, because there are really good arguments on both sides. On one side, you say DNA does not read out its own sequence, so of course human beings had to be involved in helping extract that information. You should be able to patent that. And on the other side, it is, holy, can you really patent something that you really didn't invent, but you discovered? And I think that's why the judges are having such a hard time with this case.
Well, let me ask both of you then to wrap this. What's the implications in your mind either way? So Dr. Holman, Dr. Cook-Deegan said, well, you know, you basically narrowed the focus here, but the concern people have is the wider net that's cast. So let's say they rule in favor of patenting the information. What's the broadest thing that could occur?
Well, if they did, that would be maintaining the status quo. So, because I think, like I said, for 30 years, the understanding has been that you cannot patent a naturally occurring gene. You can't patent anything that occurs in nature, but that by isolating the gene, you have a piece of DNA that is not something that really originated even in nature, and clearly it's not something that exists in nature. You don't see the isolation is what has been thought to render it patent eligible. And the patent office issued guidance more than a decade ago coming to that conclusion. So we've had kind of an understanding that you can't patent DNA as it exists in the body, but that by isolating it, you have rendered it eligible for patent protection. So I think if the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Myriad, maybe they're just going to maintain the status quo. If they were to rule in the other direction and say that these patents are claim patent ineligible material, then what I think is going to happen is it's going to introduce quite a bit of uncertainty into the law. Because it's, for one thing, it's going to be telling people that patents that they've invested a lot of money in over the last decades actually are not valid. They weren't patent eligible all along. And moving forward, I think we won't have such a clean idea of what the law is. Because right now, it's relatively easy to distinguish between isolated DNA versus DNA in the body. If they accept the argument being made by the plaintiffs here, you know, the ACLU and the lawyers, then there might be some kind of standard as, well, you cannot patent an isolated molecule like DNA unless it's markedly different, and they will not give us guidance as to what that means. It'll create a lot of uncertainty, which will affect patenting, not only involving genetic testing, but also other forms of biotech, a lot of green technologies that have nothing to do with human DNA, but other types of DNA, and also a lot of inventions like antibiotics and so forth that involve isolation of naturally occurring products. What I think is going to happen is some of those patents are going to be in danger of being invalid, and moving forward, there's just going to be uncertainty as to what you need to effectively patent those.
I see. So uncertainty, Dr. Robert Cook-Deegan, does that also mean, from your perspective, a loss of innovation? That's what some of the proponents of the patents say could occur?
Yeah, so here's the downside of eliminating all patent incentives is you don't induce the private incentive. You still have publicly funded research to try to find out how things work, but you might lose the incentive for private investment into R&D that's needed for new products and services, which adds on to this publicly funded research base that already exists. One thing on Chris's point, though, is I think the situation may not be all that dire. We just stepped out of the oral arguments. That's what we're walking away from. And I think we got a fairly strong signal that this court is likely to bend over backwards to preserve some of those incentives by saying that the kinds of patents that Chris was talking about before on engineered DNAs that don't really exist in nature, like the genes that have the spacer DNA spliced out of them, it feels, at least to me, like they are going to bend over backwards to say, hey, those are still patent eligible, and we're only talking about patenting things that correspond to the sequences found in nature.
Were the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes markedly different from what's found inside a person's body? Dr. Cook-Deegan?
That's the I don't know how many million-dollar question. We don't actually know exactly what the courts mean when they say isolated DNA.
I see.
And Chris and I have debated this many times. But what we can say is this. If you've engineered those DNAs and you've done something that allows them to produce something useful like a protein that's used in therapy, that's almost certainly patent eligible still, if I'm judging the outcome of this case accurately. What I think is still in question is, can you then also, by claiming the DNA molecules themselves, are you that correspond exactly to those that are found in nature? I'm not sure the court's going to uphold that. And what it would mean is that Myriad and one or two other companies, Athena Diagnostics, for example, would probably have to change their business models, at least on these particular patents. Now, remember, this is only some of the claims that they have in some of their patents. They have 24 patents and 500 claims. This case is about, the case heard today was only about 9 claims in 7 of those patents. So I don't think we quite know what's going to happen as the next step here, but I don't think I think the court's going to be pretty careful to be circumscribed in what they say here.
All right. We'll leave it and we'll watch. And I appreciate you coming out of those oral arguments to talking to us. Dr. Robert Cook Deegan, research professor in genome ethics and law and policy at Duke University, and Dr. Christopher Holman, associate professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, studies the intersection of intellectual property and biotech. Supreme Court hearing arguments today on gene patenting. We'll talk to you tomorrow. This is Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from Soaring Heart Natural Bed Company. For over 30 years, handcrafting mattresses and pillows. This month featuring all organic, custom-designed pillow toppers for the bed. More information and sleep resources are available by visiting their Fremont workshop or online at soaringheart.com.
It's 11 a.m., the latest from North Korea in the news in a minute.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.